The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
My fellow Americans. That was Nixon. First thing is just to say that we have had a whole series of talks every year on the history of the ISO. So you can get different perspectives and bits and pieces on the ISO's history going to wearemany.org and listening to those talks. The reason I start that way is because this is actually a slightly different talk. This is the origins of the ISO. So I'm not actually going to go through the history of the ISO, except to say that we're an amazing group, we've never made any mistakes, and everything's onward and upward from here. But I'm just saying that because it's worth people, if they're interested, going back and doing that. What I'm going to do is talk about, I don't know if I'll be successful because I kind of put this together today, is to do a kind of origins of the ISO. Some people, although not everybody who's involved in the discussion is here, will maybe hear an echo of some modern debates and discussions that are going on. Even they like what I'm saying. That's going on about the question of what socialists should do today in relationship to rebuilding the labor movement and the left. And you'll see as I go into it, and I'll come back to it at the end why I'm saying that. I want to start with just a question, frame this with the question of perspective, because the whole question about that's really important for a small group of revolutionary socialists who want to build a different kind of society is to be able to understand where you are today and then figure out what you should do next. And to be able to do that, we call that a perspective. And you need a perspective because if you don't, you can come to grief. And so, for example, just to quote a famous American socialist, James Cannon, he said, "The fate of every political group, whether it is to live and to grow or to generate and die, is decided in its first experiences by the way in which..." Thank you. Please let me finish the quote. "In which it answers two decisive questions. The first is the adoption of a correct political program, that is, your politics, and do they make sense? Basic politics. People have been through the conference, self-emancipation of the working class. Only the working class and the oppressed can liberate themselves. They can't be liberated from outside or on high. You can't take over the state. You have to have a revolutionary overthrow of it that's based on the mass action of the people. You have to be politically organized to try to build a movement that draws together the best elements of that. These are all to organize to make that possible, but it's objectively possible because of the nature of exploitation and crisis under capitalism, forces people into struggle, makes them realize that things have to change, and through the course of their own struggles for immediate demands, they develop ideas about total transformation of society, which makes socialism a possibility." Those are all kind of principles. But you can't just have a correct set of principles. You have to know what to do next, and that's what Cannon finishes with. He says, "The second is that the group decide correctly what shall be the nature of its activities and what tasks it sets itself, given the size and capacity of the group, the period of development of the class struggle, the relation of forces in the political movement, and so on. If the group understands its tasks, if it understands its politics, but doesn't know how to answer the question what to do next, it can come to grief. Like, for example, if we all sat in a room and said, insurrection is on the agenda. Crisis is impending, let's set the date. That's an extreme example of a perspective that will destroy you. Because according to that perspective, we would be trying to foment a violent overthrow of the American government as soon as possible. We're clearly not at a stage of mass struggle where that could be possible. That's an extreme example. Most of the time on the left, they're smaller examples, but they're important in terms of whether you're successful and are able to move from one link in the chain to the next. I'm going to introduce one more thing from Duncan Hallis, which is in a really important essay called Toward a Revolutionary Socialist Organization. He frames it this way, and this is a political approach or understanding which is framed, I think, the tradition of the group that the ISO came out of, the International Socialists and the ISO. And he said, it's a quote, I'm not going to read it, but he says, what happened under McCarthyism was the complete divorce of socialist politics from the working class movement. And the task of revolutionaries is to figure out how to reintegrate that. And that's really been the main central question of the socialist left for decades, that's informed discussions and debates and ideas about what we do. Because that's the gap that has to be closed. How do you reintroduce and rebuild a socialist movement that's rooted in the working class in a country, particularly in the United States, where those things have been completely severed? And people won't remember because they either weren't alive or were too young. Post-war period was a period of political reaction in which socialism came to be associated with the Soviet Union and was considered to be something that was anathema, even inside the trade union and working class movement. And people were physically removed and driven out of the working class movement. Now, socialism is no longer a dirty word. People are now open to those ideas among students, but also among workers in the United States. But that's been a long, long path of transformation that it's important to remember that this question now is renewed in a way that's different than it was then because of those changes. That is, that you can go to a picket line and say, I'm a socialist, and they go, hey, great, I voted for Bernie Sanders. You know, it's completely different than when you went to a picket line in 1970 and, you know, they were like, get the fuck out of here, you commie. You know, so really, really a kind of a different environment. So that's shaped the politics. I just want to say a little bit about a little background stuff. I know I'm not going to get through this talk because I'm talking. All right. Okay. 1960s. Big radical movement, radicalization. Students, anti-war, the black movement, Chicano movement, Puerto Rican women's movement, the beginnings of the gay lesbian liberation movement. All these things really rose up in the 60s and early 70s. Some of that spread to a certain extent among the working class. That is, for example, in Detroit, the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement. And in general, just a certain political radicalization that was going on in society as a whole around Vietnam, the women's movement, the black struggle, civil rights movement before that. That had its impact on the working class as well. Although, even through that period, there was still high levels of anti-communism that persisted. Particularly among white workers in the United States, but in general in the working class throughout that period. But this radicalization had its impact on the working class as well. And it's interesting, in between 1969 and 1975, there was a wave of strikes, many of them wildcat strikes. I don't have time to go into it, but it's important to understand in terms of a left that's developing and starting to draw revolutionary conclusions. While most of the left was very influenced by third worldist politics that looked to the oppressed but not the working class to transform society, a whole layer of the left said, workers are an important component, and so therefore we have to relate to this new development. And there were, just to give you a sense, there were 3,438 major work stoppages. Work stoppages involving more than 1,000 workers between 1947 and 1956. That then drops to 2,500 between 1957 and 1966, and then shoots up between 1967 and 1976 to 3,321. And you'll see the importance of this, from 1977 to 1986 is a precipitous drop to 1,446. So there's this 10-year rise in class struggle, many of it wildcat strikes, which are not supported by the union officials, and then that drops off. The International Socialists, which the ISO came out of, something called the Independent Socialist Clubs that were politically informed by Hal Draper. I don't have time to go into it, but based, really committed to a concept of socialism from below, class struggle unionism, no trust in the trade union bureaucracy, self-emancipation of the working class, and rejection of the Democratic Party as a vehicle for any kind of fundamental social change. And a rejection of Stalinism, you know, socialism from below, neither Washington nor Moscow. After the collapse of the Students for a Democratic Society, the Independent Socialist Clubs, which were mostly oriented on campuses, Berkeley, University of Chicago and a few other places. People can correct me if I get some of these things wrong who were around at the time, like Bill. We have some people, Celia and Bill, who are in the IS. So just so people know. They formed the International Socialists. They moved their center to Detroit, and they began to orient on this new work development of working class movement. And they also began to industrialize their members, that is mostly students, send them into industries like in Detroit, in the auto industry and other places. And this was done for the best of reasons, that is to close that gap that I described that Duncan Hallis talked about between revolutionaries and the working class, how to relink that. That had developed after World War II. I'm not going to go through the history, but in 1975, the IS made a much, much bigger turn than simply industrializing some of their members and starting to pay attention to strikes and orient on the struggles that were developing. They argued the working class is going to rapidly radicalize, and we have to be there and engage in mass work. Mass work inside the unions, that is, we have to organize rank and file groups and find immediate agitational slogans around immediate demands in the workplace, out of which the working class will radicalize, and a layer of radicalizing workers will be very quickly recruited into the IS, and in a very short period of time, because of the economic crisis and the developing radicalization, the IS would become a workers' combat organization. That was the phrase that was used. I'll go into that a little bit more. It's important to remember that this idea that revolution was imminent, and I'm going to quote you some things, was not particular to the IS. In fact, it was even more extreme among the Maoists. And they crashed even harder than the IS did, both organizationally and politically, on the idea that this onset of economic crisis in the mid-70s, there was going to be a continuation of the radicalization. It had moved to the working class. That was going to continue. And then the crisis was going to produce mass struggle on the scale of the 1930s, and it was going to open up the possibility of revolutionary change. So we had to act quickly to insert ourselves into the working class in order to take advantage of this rapidly changing situation. So that the IS argued that as the crisis deepened, the rank and file rebellion would grow, and that they needed to quickly build a working class leadership through this idea of forming rank and file groups that would engage in mass work, that had their own rank and file newspapers and so on. But at the very moment when this happened at the very moment when the economic crisis signals a sustained assault on the working class and its institutions, and a decline in radicalization, and the beginning of the rollback that we later came to understand as the employers' offensive and later neoliberalism, sustained decades-long period that has continued of employer attacks that has weakened the trade union. This was the point at which it began. So there was an enormous contradiction between the perspective and the reality. And this perspective, I should say, it wasn't just that members should go get jobs in industry. It was that they should industrialize in what was called key industries: auto, steel, mines, communication, and transport. You know, the Teamsters, auto plants in places like Detroit, the mines, that was actually never adopted. It was argued as a perspective, but they never sent their members into the mines and steel. If you'll note that the public sector was not in this. In other words, the IS did not have a strategy of organizing. That was not considered an important area of organizing and sending their members, in spite of the fact that there had been a mass national postal wildcat strike, which was the biggest and probably only national wildcat strike. Maybe I think there was one very short Teamster wildcat that was almost national. But really, the postal wildcat was the only fully national wildcat strike that had happened a few years before that. And nevertheless, that was not considered a priority. The strategy, and This strategy was summarized in an IS pamphlet that was produced in Detroit in 1975 called The Struggle for Workers' Power, and this is what they wrote, the pamphlet said. In three years, so 75, by 1978, we will become a workers' combat group in the lead of a growing rank-and-file movement or be set back severely. The core group of new revolutionary working-class political leaders will have to be recruited to the IS during this period and be rapidly prepared to assume political roles. By 3 years from now, we want them, the workers, to be the leadership of the IS, a working-class and black leadership which has already started the process of constructing factory branches. We want to double our membership by the next convention, 1976. In the next 2 years, we want to have the core of a party, worker cadres, factory branches, national rank-and-file movements, a weekly paper, a theoretical journal, a strong youth group, and a working class and black leadership. So as you can see, it was a really tall order. The impact on the membership was to hothouse. First of all, to be a member of the IS now, you had to be willing to uproot everything in your life and go at a moment's notice anywhere you were ordered to go. But it also meant that the members that weren't in a position to do that were relegated to second class status as members. If you were in, you know, if you were a newly a student that joined in Kentucky, you were very low on the priority. If you were in Boston, where it was obvious that students would be a logical place to go and try to recruit people, that was considered a low priority. New York City, no mass industry there, low priority. You go through it, and it raised all kinds of problems, which I'm going to go into, but that was one of them. Just to give you a sense of, and I'm not going to read the whole quote, but Glenn Wolfe, who was the national secretary, he had come from Britain, who essentially argued in this key document in 1975 called For a Workers' Combat Organization, the Bolshevization of the IS. He said this: "We are at the beginning of a period in which it will be objectively possible to make a revolution. Such a period has not existed on a world scale since the 1930s. And he goes on like that. In other words, it was this entire perspective based on the idea that the IS had to quickly forge itself into some kind of fighting organization that could lead a revolution. This, at the time, there's disagreements about numbers, but the IS had somewhere between 250 and 300 members when this turn was made. So a group that was, you know, less than a third of the size of the ISO. The results were varied, but the main impact was, for example, was demoralization and adaptation, I guess would be the two words I would say. One was many members became demoralized from the lack of success of what most of the rank and file work wasn't very successful. And adaptation, that is, there was a tendency among industrializing students to, and this was accentuated both by the mass work perspective, which said we should be able to lead even the most backward worker that was put that way, but also by the misreading of the period, that is, workers were not radicalizing at that point. And so you went into a workplace, you want to fit in, you want to be a worker. And so there was, you became uber worker. You know, as you students tended to, in order to fit in and not feel like the sore thumb, hi, I'm a social, I'll put on the flag and put on a leather jacket and be a worker. And so it had an impact on people, which was actually conservatizing, and they adapted culturally and also politically to a climate that was not conducive to building and sustaining not just rank and file organization, but rank and file organization that's a transmission belt towards revolutionary politics, which was the idea. It was really the other way around. The rank and file organizing became a transmission belt in the end for IS members to become good trade unionists and drop all of their revolutionary politics, which was actually the end result of the conclusions drawn by the IS. And so very little success except in a lot of failure, actually, except in the Teamsters, where they built something, Teamsters for a Democratic Contract, and then TDU, and then that, and then there was a little part of Workers' Power, their newspaper, that became Labor Notes. The problem is that the success was based upon a move away from the original goal of what the strategy had meant to accomplish, which was how to build quickly a revolutionary working class organization that could lead a revolution. Turned into, we tried that, it failed. What we really need to do is be good trade unionists. So even the places where there's things we can learn from the work that IS did, the end result was an orient a political orientation that substituted union activism for being a revolutionary, counterposed them, essentially. That union activism was one thing, being a revolutionary, workers aren't ready. I mean, we used to hear this a lot from IS members after the ISO was formed. Workers aren't ready to hear radical politics. And Labor Notes would always strive to keep revolutionary politics out of Labor Notes conventions and conferences because workers weren't ready to hear it. And what they needed to hear was how to organize your union, how to file a grievance, how to be a better organizer with a rank and file orientation, but not as a transmission belt to winning people to revolutionary politics, but actually to keep out the revolutionaries. So anyway, so there was that. This was the way, the worst development that came from that was, out of the mass work perspective, was the beginning of an adaptation to trade union bureaucrats. So for example, the one example that's in the left faction document, the faction that was kicked out in 1977 and became the ISO, said, The IS promoted Bob Weissman, president of UAW Local 122 at Chrysler's Twinsburg, Ohio stamping plant, and he was a longtime activist in that plant for 20 years, and he was also active in Cleveland City politics. He was the Republican mayor's chief labor advisor. And the IS pushed him as a leader of this rank and file group that they were involved in, and paid for and organized a Detroit rally, which featured him as a keynote speaker. And this is one of the things that the document's critical of. It says, Workers' Power recently featured without comment an interview with Weissman, November 8, 1976, in which he bragged that a strike at our plant would shut the corporation down within a week, when there actually was a strike at the Twinsburg plant, led apparently by a number of young workers infuriated by the Chrysler settlement. Weissman's talk was somewhat different. He joined with the company to break the strike and publicly denounced the strikers, promising he'd see to it that they didn't get their jobs back. So there was a real beginning of an adaptation to the trade union bureaucracy that was also developing as a result of the stalling of this rank and file, what was initially a revolutionary perspective, flipping over towards adaptation as it was clear that it was not going to be successful. And I already talked about industrialization, so I can go back to this. I don't need this. I don't need this. I already talked about it. I already talked about this. Okay, the left faction formed in late 1976. It consisted of 60, 70 people, something like that. 83, jeez. 76, 83, they can't even agree now. Couldn't even agree amongst themselves. No, anyway, okay. Let me change that. No.
1976.
Yeah, 76, right. Oh, with about 83. And it made a number of arguments. It opposed the industrialization perspective, which it argued was founded on an unrealistic assessment of the state of the working class and its level of radicalization, and its level of coherence in terms of class struggle. Another argument was that the movement's very fragmented, and there's not you can't really develop any kind of united picture of the class struggle. And the other thing it criticized was the industrialization policy. So it was both a critique of that the perspective was overblown and of the idea of industrializing in key industries as a strategy, as a national strategy for building a tiny revolutionary organization. It wrote, the task of revolutionaries today is to take advantage of what actually exists, to build on the real struggles of the working class, not to pretend to plan the development of the struggle by choosing the three or four priority industries. Our task in the IS today is not to replace the present priorities with new ones, whether white collar, hospitals, or whatever. We must prepare ourselves to intervene, to give a lead in the struggles to come, including the inevitable explosions that will come. Preparing ourselves politically and organizationally, however, is not the same thing as trying to substitute ourselves for such explosions. And it argued, I have a quote I wanted to read. I missed. Sorry, I need to find this quote. This is very important. Oh, damn it, I lost the quote. Damn, it was such a good quote. Okay, here we go. I got it. So both Duncan Hallis from the British SWP also wrote a letter intervening and saying this is disastrous. You have an overblown perspective. If you build on bluff, bluster, and bullshit, and you're not honest about what you're capable of, you will crack up. You will come to grief. We say this from our own experience. We also want to let you know that this industrialization perspective is problematic in the ways that I described earlier, but also we, who are still a very small organization, but are, 10 times your size in a country that's, a tenth of your size, so we're way bigger than you are, we still don't believe that we're a party or that we're that we can do what you claim that you can do. And we should let you know that we built dozens of factory branches and recruited hundreds of workers, but it was mostly done. It was not, obviously there are individual people who themselves decided to go and get jobs, some of them former students in industry, but we never had it as a policy. And in fact, most of our recruitment came from public sector workers and students and other revolutionaries in the SWP doing strike support work and recruiting workers into the IS politically. In other words, not by being the, because, while we obviously, wherever we are, we strive to be leaders in the struggle, we don't have any illusion that at this stage we are going to be the leadership of the class or that we're in a position to lead mass struggles on a national basis. We have to recruit people, we have to go where people are. And they use the example of the SWP in Minneapolis in the 30s, and they said, nobody thought trucking was a priority. There were some militant workers who were in the SWP who said, they knew the guy who was the head of the local, it was a tiny local of truckers, and he said, why don't you come in and let's see what we can do? And they went in and they ended up in this big strike that's now one of the most famous strikes in American history. It was unplanned. It was not part of a national strategy. And that's a point I want to make, is that it's like the idea that you close the barn door after all the animals have escaped. The class struggle doesn't go according to a plan. No one knew what was going to happen in West Virginia. Nobody knew what was going to happen after that, right? No one predicted that, okay? No one can predict. Maybe somebody can, maybe you met them, I don't know. But no one can predict where struggle will break out. Nobody predicted Black Lives Matter. Nobody can tell you that, because there's nothing going on right now in logistics, that's going to go on for the next 20 years. We do not know. We don't know where things will explode. We're a tiny group. We're bigger than the IS was then, but the idea that we're going to go and say, here are the places where we must send everyone, because, and this is the really important point that they make in the Left Action document, to come back to this, is they said, look, it's clear that, and this is at a time when Detroit and Otto in Detroit was a key part of the working class. And if you're going to build a revolutionary movement in the United States, you have to organize auto workers. That's absolutely true. However, that goal can't be substituted for a wish. That wish can't be substituted for a strategy. You can't say, because we need that, we just go in. We just send everybody in. Because the result of that was zero. The result of that effort the Detroit branch of the IS was considered the most important branch. It was always considered the most important branch in the IS. And according to the Left Action document, it was constantly being reorganized. It was constantly being shifted. It was constantly in crisis. It was constantly having to come to grips with the fact that it wasn't having any success in the rank and file work that it was doing in auto. So you can't substitute what you wish for what's real. Workers have potential power. That doesn't tell you how, when, and where it's going to break out. And so it is, I think, correct to say that you need to go where you can find people in struggle and people who are politicizing. Sometimes that's in the workplace, sometimes it's in a movement, sometimes it's at an airport, sometimes it's in an immigration detention center, and working class people go to those things too. The woman who got killed in Charlottesville was a working class woman. We didn't, so a working class perspective isn't just how we rebuild the labor movement. It's about how do we build a working class movement that can overthrow capitalism. I'm drifting off. Okay, so this is what they say, and I'm going to quote this. The path to socialism cannot be charted or planned. Today there is very little consistency in the class struggle. American workers struggle, but their struggles are fragmented and sporadic. And remember, this is in 1976, when the level of class struggle was much higher than it is now. A glance at working class history shows that great explosions are rarely predicted. The women began the Russian Revolution. Portuguese teachers were the first ones out in the latest resurgence of Portuguese workers. Coal miners in the United States today are the most anti-communist workers. They don't say it, but you would know if you were reading it at the time. Prior to that, coal miners were among the most militant, radical workers. The first ones today will later be the last. All the planning of the IS Executive Committee, all its expert deliberations were not sufficient to predict that the 1976 auto strike would be at Ford, and consequently, in the words of the National Secretary, when the strike began, the IS was as useless as a third, you know, whatever. Okay, so the task of revolutionaries today is to take advantage of what actually exists, to build on the real struggles of the working class, not to pretend to plan the development of the struggle by choosing the three or four priority industries. Our task in the IS today is not to replace the present priorities with new ones, whether white collar hospitals or whatever. So that's kind of some of what I had already summarized, but it's a very good quote. And so to try to, how much have I got? 5 minutes?
Yeah, but I was thinking it's a two-hour meeting.
So. No, I'm fine. I'm almost done. Okay, so I got to scroll down now, so just give me a second here to the end of my talk. Okay, so this is this perspective that the left faction argued. Said a small revolutionary group must be primarily a propaganda group. That didn't mean that it simply put out propaganda, but that it understood that it had limits to what was possible and that it couldn't have pretensions that it could lead the class struggle in ways that were not yet possible. That being such a group meant finding ways to intervene wherever it was possible to engage in politics and meet people, not by national schemes like industrialization, but by building where you can. To do this, it needed a newspaper that had a higher level of politics. It did not, like the IS paper, Workers' Power, try to have a mass appeal, but try to appeal to the most radicalizing sectors of society. That paper, they argued, with the IS paper, Workers' Power, was being underutilized because of this depoliticization involved in the industrialization work. People were being sold rank and file papers that talked about nuts and bolts issues in the plant. Tending to avoid issues like race, women's liberation, things like that, and focusing on narrow trade union questions. And I knew that from firsthand experience. When I first came to the U.S., there were two members of the ISO, me and Peter Court, and we went to these meetings of the concerned transit workers, which the IS at that time was heavily involved in. And the most striking thing we noticed right away is that the IS members in the room had stacks of Workers' Power that just sat there through the whole meeting that no one ever tried to sell, like stack of like 50 Workers' Power. We'd be like, why aren't you selling your paper? And because it wasn't part of what they did at that point. So the paper kind of became a fifth wheel or an appendix that they just stopped using. Was it in 1977 that the left faction was expelled? It was at a convention. Was it a special convention? Or in 77. What month?
March
of 1977. The IS called a special convention and expelled the left faction. And I went back and looked through copies of Workers' Power that talked about that convention. And one of the arguments that was used against the left faction was that they were like scabs. They were scabbing on the workers' movement by opposing the perspectives of the IS. I don't have time to quote it, but that was definitely there. So the ISO, the reason it exists, and I'll just finish with this, was immediately formed after the expulsion. Everybody involved in it understood that most times these sorts of things happen, you sink under the waves and it's all over. And they said, we have to immediately put out a monthly paper, and we have to immediately begin organizing as a different organization based on a different different assessment. And I'm just going to quote from a 1978 perspectives document written by the National Secretary of the ISO at the time, Cal Winslow, because it does, I think, give you a sense of how the group understood what it was trying to do politically at its start. The first step must be an honest, realistic appraisal of the circumstances under the present balance of forces. In the United States, 1978, we must recognize above all the weakness of the left. The events of the past 40 years has isolated the revolutionary left from the working class. Nowhere was this isolation more complete than in the US. For the past 25 years, socialists have played virtually no role in the main worker struggles, and even today, socialists remain very few in number. We can in no way ignore or minimize this reality. To do so is to seriously underestimate the difficulties ahead, the scale of the task, and to exaggerate the pace of development. Proclaiming new communist parties, programs for building the leadership, chest beating about workers' combat organizations, all this simply makes the situation more difficult. And so these were the basic hallmarks. Anti-Stalinism, continuation of the tradition. Socialism from below, centrality of the working class. Second, the working class needs a revolutionary party, but we're not it. We have to try to figure out how to play a role in building such a thing, but we can't have any pretensions that we somehow are going to grow and morph into the revolutionary party. That was always clear, maybe not really understood in the ISO from its beginning. We can make a small contribution to that effort if we are upfront with our politics, keep the red flag flying, but are realistic about what's possible and relate to everything we can, every real struggle, and not get bent out of shape, which ended up happening, by the way. I'm not going to go into that. I'm not going to talk about all the different things that we learned after that, because there's no time for that in the talk. So there's really the two things that we were very cautious of at the time, being so overwhelmed by the scale of the task and our puny resources that we become passive and turn into a purely propaganda group, or substitutionism, the attempt to substitute small group and its activities for the working class. Those are the two twin things that we wanted to oppose. And as a result of that, we were able to grow modestly a small group in a period where the left was disintegrating and falling apart. And that's really, I mean, that's extremely important. We rejected the triumphalism of, you know, the idea of a workers' combat organization. We had a strong commitment to openness, political openness, we had to present socialist politics in a way that made sense to people, but that didn't back off from the hard questions and so on. So I'll just finish by saying, some people might know then why I said at the beginning why these debates are important again. One is because the question of socialism in the working class is more important than it has been in a long time. The question of real possibility is of linking those things together in various ways. And so the question of how to do that is again extremely important, and I hope that the history of the origins of the ISO will contribute to a broader discussion and a more particular discussion also in the International Socialist Organization about some of these questions, in particular the question of industrialization, concentration, and how and when and under what circumstances a national strategy can actually develop in a serious revolutionary organization, to what extent we're still trying to figure out and be open to the various possibilities that they develop and intervening at those points to find the people that are open and willing to engage with revolutionary politics.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.